Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
This is True Crime Cast. Jamie and John here. What is happening?
Dude, not a whole lot. How are you doing, man?
Not a whole lot. It feels like everything is moving so fast. We're in December. Feels like Thanksgiving was yesterday, which it kind of was. And then, I don't know, Christmas is coming, trying to wrap up year-end projects at day job, trying to get ahead so we can travel for the holidays.
Yeah, that's a pretty accurate description of my life. Throw in several plays there and Ubering kids everywhere, and you've nailed it.
Yeah, I mean, whoever came up with the Uber idea obviously is super rich, but I think they were just a parent and they were like, what if I got paid to do this? Because this is all I do.
If like I could pick up people and take them somewhere in between my runs, taking my children places,
yeah,
I could be a billionaire.
Yeah, no kidding. Not at all.
I've charged my kids. They owe me so much money.
So much. They're in such debt. I get it. Funny that we talk about debt because our first 5-star review is from Rich Under 97.
Nice.
I assume his name is Rich Under, which is a solid wrestler name, I think.
Mm-hmm. He says, Down Under, maybe.
I found out about this podcast from Talk Is Jericho and has been hooked ever since. I work third shift in a dark building, and it definitely gets me paranoid to walk around a corner. Keep up the good work, guys.
You should always be paranoid to walk around corners.
Yes. Especially.
You never know what's lurking.
A true crime podcast. Yeah. So thank you very much, Rich Under, for the 5-star review. We do read those every week, and great way to recommend new cases.
We had a case recommendation come in, and that was for the suitcase killer. And we posted that episode on December the 1st. So that episode is only available to Patreon members. So if you haven't already joined, go to patreon.com. Check us out. For as little as a few bucks a month, you can get access to early ad-free content and a bonus episode each and every month. And there's like almost 100 over there. So go check it out.
There's a lot going on. There really is. And there's a lot going on in this story today, John. It's one that I've known about for a while. And honestly, continue to try to wrap my head around what exactly happened. It's very tragic and just so many questions about what actually went down, what motives were, and what caused things. So if you like mysteries, even though they are horribly tragic, then this is a good case for you. Why don't you get us rolling?
All right, man. Diane Schuler, she had a less than ideal childhood. When she was just 9 years old, her mother allegedly ran off with a neighbor and left her 4 children behind. So definitely, Diane's mom did not win Mother of the Year. Diane was the only girl with 2 older and 1 younger brother. She had no female figure in her life to hold her, to nurture her, to show her how to be a woman. And, I mean, she wasn't even a teenager yet, so she had to go through all of her very hard teenage years alone. Diane said that she had to grow up with a tough exterior to protect herself. Her high school friends described her as funny. She was a class clown and well-liked among her classmates. I just want to stop there and discuss that. Like, some of the happiest people that you know are probably the ones who have the darkest souls because they are masking a lot oftentimes.
I think not about everybody. That. I think about that quite a bit. I mean, I think it happens a lot with comedians. That's what Robin Williams talked a lot about before taking his own life. So it certainly can be something where you're trying to mask it.
Her friends in school said that her mother was a topic that was off limits. She did not want to talk about her mom. You know, when you're abandoned, there's so much resentment, anger, sadness, you're wondering why, you know, and oftentimes for children that manifests in what about me was so wrong that made my mother run off. I don't know that that's what she experienced. That is a common experience. She had moved on from her estranged mother who died in 2013. When her mother died, Diane's brothers had reconciled with her, but Diane refused to acknowledge her mother.
But she did reconnect with her brothers, which I think is a very important part of what's going on here. She did get married as well. She met her husband in middle school, Not that they had been together since then. They reunited at a wedding of a common friend from high school. During that event, Diane had lost a significant amount of weight and was the slimmest she had ever been. Again, some people would equate that with being healthy, but that's a big sign sometimes of being unhealthy, both physically, potentially mentally, emotionally. I think we equate size with happiness and healthiness in our country, and that's not necessarily
the case. Well, if the opposite is true, that I am the most mentally healthy person you could ever meet.
I really appreciate it when you say it before I do, because it sounds less mean. So her husband, whose name is Daniel, worked nights as a security guard, and his mom described him as Diane's oldest child, which I think you and I can empathize with that as well. We, our wives,
from our wives' perspectives, to be clear,
raised several kids, and I think they would consider us amongst them. They were married, and they ended up having two kids, Brian and Aaron. Now, Daniel was not very involved as a father. He said he didn't really want children, so not only was he kind of a, not a burden, but he had to be taken care of by Diane, and she had pretty much the full burden day-to-day of raising their kids.
And she took it very seriously. Her children were always neat and clean and appeared cared for. She ironed their clothes every day. That's so much more than I would ever do for my children.
Yes.
I love them, but I don't iron their clothes. Throwing them in the dryer, that's the extent of it. She did their hair perfectly every day. She made them dinner, gave them baths, and did individual story times with their children every night. So, yeah, that seems like a good mom, right?
It's Mother of the Year stuff right there.
She stayed up with her children, making family photo albums to give out as gifts. Diane was the first parent at morning drop-off, and she was the first one there to pick them up every afternoon. We have some parents like that around here, and schools have had to get on Facebook and say, school is out at 3. There is no reason for you to be here waiting in the car rider line at 1 p.m.
Yeah, and that's not an exaggeration at all. People literally show up 2 hours early. I don't know if they don't have anything else to do. I don't know if getting out of that parking lot instantly is the most important thing in the world to them, but it's really annoying for those of us getting caught in traffic. Sorry for the side rant, but I'll say
one more thing. Our school system posted this week that if it happens again, they're going to start writing tickets.
So okay, good.
I like that. Anyway, yeah, she was the first one there to pick them up every afternoon, so that's what my brain thinks of. Now, she did this all while working as the director of a credit and billing and collection service at Cablevision. She made six figures, joined the PAT, was involved in tons of school functions. This woman was one who did everything. I like it because it kind of reminds me of me.
You are a very busy individual and like to be heavily involved, and I appreciate that.
Probably to a fault, but Diane's closest friend was Christine Lapini, and she said that we were kind of not very similar in a lot of ways. I'm a very easygoing person, and a lot of things pass, but she had to be in charge of everything. There was nothing left to chance. You know, everything had to be planned, precise. She was a powerful woman. She was very much in charge of everything, whether that be at work, at home, in the car, in the friendship. She was certainly not a perfect person. She loved you. She loved you. And if she didn't, then she could be difficult. She was okay as long as she was in control of everything. End quote. Jamie, is this a joke? Are you writing about me?
This isn't you. Your involvement, I think, has less to do with control and more to do with other psychological issues we don't have time to get into. But no, I don't think this is your burden. But I think we all have these type people in our lives that, you know, once their name gets mentioned and they're joining a group of some kind, that they're not going to be an idle member. They're going to be seeking leadership and sometimes for the right reasons, sometimes not, but they always want to have a say in what happens.
I don't think mine is a control issue as much as I think that there's no one who can do it as good as I do.
Yeah. I think that's probably true.
So fair enough. All right. So that need for control ultimately had Diane feeling very isolated. She had no one that she felt like she could open up to. And, you know, that's hard when you're struggling on the inside. So maybe if she had a motherly or sisterly bond with someone, then things could have turned out a little differently.
Yeah, so she didn't have that outlet. She did have friends, obviously. You just mentioned Christine, but she really couldn't relate to her. And her husband's not super involved with the kids, and she's kind of taking care of him in the same way she is them. So certainly, I think wound up at this point in her life, I think, is the right way to look at Diane's state. Now, we're going to go to July of 2009, where the incident in question happens. Diane, Daniel, their two kids, Brian, who was 5, and Aaron, who was 2, along with Diane's 3 nieces, Emma, 8 years old, Allison, 7, Katie, 5, were all camping at Hunter Lake Campground in Parksville, New York. On July 26th, Daniel drove back to West Babylon, New York, in his gray Toyota pickup truck.
This was back in 2009?
Yes. He took the family dog with him, and Diane took all 5 kids in a minivan that she had borrowed from her brother and sister-in-law. Again, this is, she's close to her brother, she's taking her nieces, so she took their van along for the trip to be able to haul everybody. She got on the road to her brother's house, where her Jeep was parked for the weekend. Her brother Warren and his wife Jackie had no reason to worry about their kids. They fully believe that Diane and Daniel, both in their mid-30s, could handle 5 kids and a dog. They weren't concerned in any way whatsoever. After a weekend of having a great time playing out in the woods, Diane got on the road with all the kids around 9:30 that morning. Again, this is July 26, 2009. The campground owner was a friend of them, and he spoke with Diane before they left and said that everything appeared normal. And as with most of our stories, when everything starts to feel normal is when it gets out of hand. And that's where things go off the rails for Diane and these kids.
On their way back home, Diane stopped at a McDonald's for drinks and some food. That's what families do sometimes if you, you know, are a McDonald's family. Some families are Chick-fil-A families, and we don't judge.
No judging.
The employee at the McDonald's said that she was acting totally normal. So again, this is a second person who thinks that she's acting normal. The crew also made a pit stop at a Sunoco gas station where Diane went in and asked for a specific painkiller. The store was out of what she asked for, so she left. The man behind the counter said that Diane was acting alert and normal, but either she or someone in the car needed a painkiller.
Yeah, and to be clear, she's not going in there asking for oxys. She's looking for something over the counter. They just didn't have it, whether that was Tylenol, Aleve, ibuprofen, whatever.
Now, this guy would go on to say that he knew for a fact that she was not drunk when she came into the gas station. She seemed fine, but she did ask for Tylenol. That's a normal request and something that you would think most gas stations would carry.
And I think most minivans have it. So maybe she just ran out in the car. Minivan.
Yeah. Like, did you check your purse, Diane? They also noted that Diane was rubbing her cheek and leading some to believe that perhaps she was suffering from an abscessed tooth. Diane left the gas station at 11 a.m., traveling along Route 17 and Interstate 86. Several witnesses later reported the red minivan along that route aggressively tailgating, flashing her headlights and honking the horn, and weaving in and out of traffic. At 8:37 a.m., Diane called her brother from the minivan, telling him they were going to be late because of traffic.
Now, what we don't have are reports about whether this was normal behavior for Diane. Knowing that she liked to be in control, I could totally see her being a road rage type person. And maybe not violently so, but getting frustrated by traffic because it's straying her plans away from her intentions. So still, at this point, she's going to be late. Everybody says she's normal. Now, 11:45 a.m., shortly after she called her brother, witnesses say they saw Diane get out of the van and vomit on the side of the road. Again, she's maybe sick of some kind. I know if you're rubbing your jaw, that could be a toothache. That could be sinuses that could have drained into her stomach. I mean, the reason she threw up could be numerous. At 12:08 p.m., Jackie called Diane back And she said, this was, again, after she had thrown up, she sounded fine and coherent while they were talking about tickets to a church event for the kids. Everything seemed fine. But then at 12:58 p.m., Warren got a call from his oldest daughter, and this is Emma, 8 years old, in the van with Diane. Emma was very upset, and you could hear the other kids crying in the background. John, the first thing going through my head here is, did you guys crash? Is everybody okay? Did somebody hurt you? What's wrong with Diane? And immediately, that's what Emma says. There's something wrong with Aunt Diane. Warren called her phone at 102, and Diane answered, but she was kind of slurring her words. She was disoriented, and she kept calling her brother Danny. Obviously, that's her husband, not her brother. So she, sometime between 1208 and 1258, started to lose her cognitive abilities. And it really scared the kids. She tried to downplay them being scared, say they're just being silly, they're playing and messing with you. But obviously, Warren was concerned. He begged Diane to wait, pull over, let me come check on you, let me come get the kids, whatever you need. If something's going on, and I think it is because you're slurring your words, let's take extra care here. She ended the call, and Warren kept trying to call her back, but she wouldn't answer the phone. So we've gone from normal to scary instantly.
I mean, slurring your words, if the gas station guy was like certain that she wasn't intoxicated, the only thing I can think of is like a stroke.
Right. Some kind of mental break.
But I've never heard of anyone becoming like, I don't know. We're going to get there eventually, but something happens and I've never heard of anyone else doing that when they have a stroke.
Right.
As it turns out, Diane had left her cell phone along the highway. It was later found by the side of the road near some toll booths. Diane made her way to the Taconic State Parkway, and at 1:31 p.m., the 911 calls started coming in. There were at least six people that called, reporting that on the northbound Taconic, a minivan in the right-hand lane was going southbound. So she's driving into oncoming traffic.
Right.
Diane was going the wrong way down the highway at speeds of up to 85 miles an hour. This is, or can be, catastrophic. We've seen this happen along I-75 near where we live, and the results are horrific. One driver who witnessed the van said that for a minute we were like, is that a car? It's so surreal to see something coming at you when you're driving, you know, with the flow of traffic, there shouldn't be anything coming at you. And that's what they saw. So he also said the minivan wasn't swerving. She stayed in a straight line and it came speeding past us at like 80 miles per hour. He said it was the one of the most eeriest things that he had ever seen. She ended up going at least 1.7 miles before she ended up colliding head-on with the 2004 Chevy Trailblazer, which then struck a 2002 Chevy Tracker at approximately 1:35 p.m.
Yeah, and this is a minivan, so a substantial vehicle, as is a Trailblazer. The Tracker usually is a pretty small, I don't even know if you can call it an SUV, but certainly a multi vehicle crash and going the wrong direction, hitting head on. I mean, it doesn't get much scarier than an impact like that. There were two guys that saw the crash and they saw the smoke coming from the minivan and they ran over and tried to help. They removed Diane from the vehicle. And while they did so, they noticed that there was a large broken bottle of Absolut vodka near the driver's seat. The men pulled the girls out of the minivan. None of them had been in car seats, and none of them had seat belts on, and noted that none of the girls had pulses when they were pulled from the van. John, when you and I grew up, we did not, or at least I did not, wear seat belts until I started driving myself. I think by 2009, that was a much more common thing to do. Would you agree that most, especially with kids?
Yes, but yeah, for sure. I remember growing up, but even in high school, I would wear them, but before that, if we were just going on a quick trip, I would never would, but I feel like even on the highway, no matter how old I was wearing them.
So then you start to check on the individuals in the other vehicles, and they quickly concluded that there were multiple lives lost due to this accident. Diane herself, her two-year-old daughter, Erin, her nieces, Emma and Allison, along with the passengers in the SUV, Michael Bastardi, 81, and his son, Guy, 49, and their longtime friend, Daniel Loggo, 74. The people in the Tracker had minor injuries. It didn't take the full blow of the head-on collision. And Diane's five-year-old son, Brian, and her five-year-old niece, Katie, were taken to a nearby hospital. Katie did not make it. She died later that day, bringing the total deaths to 8. Brian was the only survivor from the minivan. He had broken bones, he had severe head trauma, and he ended up staying in the hospital for weeks. Didn't end up going home till October, and this is July. So definitely some severe injuries, long-lasting effects for Brian. But we have this lady who goes camping with her nieces and her kids. And on the way back, all of a sudden, she starts slurring her words, driving the wrong way, and hits somebody head on. And when I say mystery, I mean, the questions abound here. Did she drink the vodka? Did she have some kind of mental breakdown? Did she do this on purpose? And I think that's what we want to start digging into now.
Well, there was an investigation. A toxicology report was released in August, and it showed that Diane's blood alcohol content was 0.19%.
Yowza.
That's approximately 6 grams of alcohol in her stomach that had not yet been absorbed into her blood. The legal limit to drive is 0.08.
So she was
over double the legal limit.
And she still had alcohol in her stomach. So she was over double the limit on her way to more drunkenness.
Yeah. Police said that Diane's blood alcohol content was equivalent of taking 10 shots of alcohol in a single hour. There was also evidence that she had smoked marijuana shortly before the crash. Many people just simply could not believe this. Diane's best friend said that this is so out of the realm of the possibility of her that it just blows her mind. She claimed that this was not the behavior of someone that was a devoted parent like she was, and she said that her friend Diane rarely drank alcohol. Her husband Daniel also said that he could not believe it, saying, "I never saw her drunk. Since the day I met her, he had never saw her drunk." He said the bottle that was found in the car was because they always kept an old bottle in the camper. And he insisted that his wife was not an alcoholic, and she must have been suffering from some kind of medical crisis, supporting the idea that she maybe had a tooth abscess that led her to this behavior. I'm going to say, dude, like, if she is having a tooth abscess, I know firsthand that that is excruciating pain. And I have seen people in excruciating pain drink specifically vodka to help dull the pain that they're feeling.
Right.
So we're going to talk about possibilities here, but log that as one possibility, I guess.
Yeah, certainly on the table. But again, if he can confirm this is the old bottle, then there's no way, because it was broken, to know how much was in it at the time of the accident. Was it full and she drank half of it all at once and then smoked marijuana? It's almost impossible to know at this point because the bottle was broken and the scene was just horrific. There were some people in Diane's life who said, you know what, I can wrap my head around this. Another one of her sister-in-laws told investigators that Diane smoked marijuana just about every day and that she had confided in her sister-in-law that she was a hard drinker. Initially, Daniel had said that neither of them had any drugs or alcohol the entire weekend, but as time went on, he fessed up and admitted that he and Diane had drank a little bit during the camping trip, but he insisted that she didn't have anything to drink the morning they left the campground and that she didn't have access to it. Plus, all the people Diane came across that morning from the campground to the McDonald's and the gas station said she didn't smell of alcohol, she didn't stagger, she didn't slur her words, and she did not appear drunk. Tom Ruskin is a private investigator that was hired by Daniel's lawyers to look into the case. Ruskin told reporters in early September that he had interviewed Diane's relatives, none of whom had ever seen her intoxicated by alcohol. He also pointed out that the autopsy results didn't show organ damage you'd expect from chronic alcoholics. So, okay, if we accept this as fact, and we only have a couple people saying they've seen her drink, most people closest to her say they haven't seen her drink. Don't want to get too much into it, but in my experience with alcohol, it can be hidden for lengths of time from certain people, even close people to you. So I have a hard time believing that I have a hard time ruling out the possibility that she did have alcohol issues. Also, just because she didn't have issues doesn't mean she wasn't drunk that morning. So
absolutely. Well, I mean, it's interesting. The autopsy didn't show organ damage that you would find. So maybe this was something that she did because of the pain, but maybe she just had really good organs. I mean, I don't know. You know what I mean?
And maybe it was more of a recent thing. Like usually when you talk about a chronic alcoholic, that's months, years of drinking. Maybe it just was the last few weeks. Who knows?
As far as the marijuana is concerned, Daniel denied Diane used it regularly, but she did have it occasionally to cope with insomnia. Daniel and his attorney alleged that Diane was driving erratically because of a sudden medical emergency. They theorized that it could have been a stroke, a tooth abscess that she'd had for weeks before her death, or it could have been that in her leg she might have had an embolism that broke loose. That, you know, that can mimic a stroke because it goes to your brain like a, you know, that causes stroke-like symptoms. The autopsy did not show signs of a stroke, an aneurysm, or a heart attack.
Yeah, so essentially that would be some kind of clot in her leg that could have caused a brain reaction. Normally, it's pretty, I don't want to say easy, but normally they can tell when a stroke has happened. That's something that's fairly common enough to where we can diagnose it. So certainly of interest to note that that wasn't the case, because I think this is, if there was no alcohol, I would think that's what this most closely looks like. A month after the autopsy, a New York forensic pathologist noted that a hair test should have been carried out to truly determine her drug history, because a hair test can tell you more about when you had drugs and how much. Daniel said that he had planned to exhume Diane's body to perform the hair test. To this day, there's no evidence that she has ever been exhumed. And trying to put myself in his shoes, sorry to steal your thing here, John, but putting yourself in somebody else's shoes, I can't imagine having to lay my wife to rest and then have her exhumed. That decision would be brutal for the entire family. So, and the issue here is that we're trying to figure out why this happened. And there's a lot of blame being thrown around. The medical examiner ruled this crash a homicide because of her negligent driving, no matter what was on the toxicology report. On October 18th of 2009, the Westchester County District Attorney said there would be no charges filed because the only responsible party was dead, that being Diane.
I feel like I keep a clean house. I think my house is fairly clean, but I think that even within a year of my wife passing, I could probably find one of her hairs at this house. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I wonder if they tried to do so.
Yeah, that's a great point. I could go and find like the shower drain.
I was going to say, just pull the shower drain. Yeah.
Yeah. So I totally get that. And I don't know that they looked there, but the point is he was trying to clear his wife's name to say, no, this was all medical. It had nothing to do with substance abuse. She had some type of issue where she was either rushing to get help, and that's why she was driving so fast the wrong way, or she had some kind of mental issue that took away her ability to think rationally. But the Bastardi family claimed that they were mishandling the case by neglecting to initiate a grand jury to investigate the crash. They wanted an official, in the books, in writing determination of what they thought happened. In December, the family filed a civil suit against Diane's estate and her brother Warren seeking damages for wanton, unwillful, and reckless conduct, which I think probably what they wanted the legal investigation for is to be able to use it in the civil case. They included Warren because of a state law that he should be included because he was the owner of the minivan. Then in July of 2011, Jackie sued Daniel, claiming that her three daughters suffered terror, fear of impending death, and extreme horror leading up to their death. So fright and mental anguish. So we have people in the other vehicles suing Warren and everything Diane owned, which include Daniel's money and assets. Then we have Jackie suing Daniel. Remember, Jackie was married to Warren, so this is an absolute legal mess. And then Daniel sues the state of New York for not keeping the road safe.
This is too much.
For not creating a way to prevent her from getting on the road in this way. I think if she really wanted to do this, or if she truly had a break in a way that prohibited her from thinking clearly, that she would have found a way to do it. By July of 2014, all the lawsuits were either dropped or settled. So legally, it was over. When people ask Jackie about this to this day, she says, "People always ask how I feel about Diane. You can't imagine how complex that question is. How does a person go from being like a sister to me, adored by my girls and cherished by my husband, to being the one who ruined our lives?" I think that's a pretty clear statement, and I think that's about as clear as you're going to get.
In August of 2009, the New York governor at the time, David Paterson, proposed what was called the Child Passenger Protection Act. This would make it a felony to drive intoxicated if there is a passenger under the age of 16 in the car. I feel like, and maybe it's changed now, but I feel like anytime someone drives intoxicated, it should be a felony, because you never know if you're going to pass a child under the age of 16 in another car.
Yeah, so. I think that's a bad law. You're right, and it should be. You're putting kids at risk anytime you do that, whether they're in your car or not.
Now, it did pass. It became known as Leandra's Law, and that was because of the death of an 11-year-old killed in a car accident while the driver was inebriated. The act was signed into law on November 18th, 2009. In 2011, HBO premiered a documentary outlining the events leading up to this tragedy, and it's called There's Something Wrong with Aunt Diane. You can watch it, but our writer, Mackenzie, recommends a warning that there are uncensored crash scene photos, and they do not warn you that there are dead bodies that will be shown. So just heads up if you're interested.
Yeah, I have seen that. That's where I first heard about this case, and I mean, it dives into everybody, and you get to see and hear from the people involved, and it's very intense.
Yeah. To this day, Diane's family refuses to accept the test results. Jackie and Warren had another child via IVF, and it was a girl. They also started a foundation whose main purpose is to honor the lives of their three daughters, and the organization aims to provide innovative self-esteem educational programming for children. Their central project, Beautiful Me, is a self-esteem program that is designed to educate girls by promoting appreciation for their genuine qualities, accurate self-awareness, and the satisfaction of helping others. This is a tragic case, and regardless of the whys, the fact of the matter is so many lives were lost that day, and it's just nothing's ever going to bring them back. No lawsuit's ever going to be enough to help. For my own curiosity, I would love to know what caused all of this.
And I think that's the big question, right? And unfortunately, civil suits are not public record, so we don't get to know what was found, what was settled. And I think we could have found some answers in there. What is publicly available? The fact that there was that much alcohol in her system, I think it would be irresponsible to ignore that. But was that a symptom of what was happening, or was that the end of what was happening? Was that the beginning? Was this all because she got drunk, or did she drink because of the medical issue? And did that just compound it? What would have happened anyway? How much of a role did the alcohol play? I don't know the answer to that. I do think that, I mean, I just can't imagine getting drunk enough to do what she did. And people do a lot of things. Like, I don't have to be able to imagine it, but I got this gut feeling that there was something else involved in addition to the alcohol. Does that justify it? No. But I think there was something else going on.
It's hard to cover this case and leave with the speculation that she intended to do this. I just can't say that. But regardless of your intentions, it happened. But man, this is so awful. So,
then you go back and you look at, she left her phone by the side of the road. Was that intentional? Did she just drop it while she stopped to throw up?
You know what it makes me think? It makes me think that she was not a heavy drinker all the time, and that this was something that she did sporadically because she was in a lot of pain. That's, yeah. I mean, that's kind of where I land, but then we do have conflicting reports that she was a heavy drinker, but her husband and her autopsy don't really back that up.
And I will say the time between her last sighting at the gas station and the timing of Emma's phone call, which is what the documentary is named after, I do think there was plenty of time for the alcohol to take effect. So I don't think him saying she was fine rules out her being drunk. I think that was about an hour, which is plenty of time chug it to get to feel it.
It makes me think that she went in with the intention of buying Tylenol. They didn't have any, and she's like, this is hurting so bad, I got to do something. So did she go and find the vodka and chug it?
And overdo it.
Yeah, that's kind of where, you know, if you just walk a logical path, I think that's not one that you could ignore.
I think you're right. Tragic nonetheless, mysterious case, 8 lives lost, and obviously the ripples of that continue to impact this family to this day. I'm always amazed that families that turn this into something positive with the Beautiful Me Project and things like that. So certainly kudos to them for that. And if you're interested to support that, just you can search Beautiful Me with the names there of Jackie and Warren. But yeah, I wish I had better answers. I'm curious to know what other people think, if whether or not you've seen the documentary. Are we way out of line to assume that something led to the alcohol? Was this just the alcohol? Do you have any other insight medically into what may have happened? I'd love to hear thoughts.
Yeah. Or did she snap? I mean, she was a very stressed out person. Was she, you know, hiding a lot more, you know, under the surface of her life?
Yeah, so much going on. But guys, we appreciate you listening. Love to hear your feedback and what you think about this one. And we'll be back with another one before long.
Guys, we appreciate you. Don't forget, if you are binge listening to everything we put out and you need more, check out patreon.com.
Yep. And I would love to read your name on a 5-star review in the next coming weeks.
Until next crime, this has been True Crime Cast.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.